A transformation has been taking place in the vineyards and wineries of Portugal during the last 20 years, bringing a number of new wines onto the international markets. Indigenous grapes that were once obscure are now becoming mainstream. Thought as a country that produced mainly red wine, Portugal is now proving that it is a producer capable of making world-class white wines while tapping in its long history for winemaking. With my guest Richard Mason, author of The Wines of Portugal, we spotlighted where and how those changes are taking place. He especially divided the country in four broad areas: Atlantic wines, the mountain wines, wines of the plain, and wines of the islands. We explore those areas and what are the key changes that are taking place and what one should know about them. We also explore the Asian Vino d'Italia and what are the categories Encrusado and Garafeglia and much more. Before we start, I would like to shout out to fellow wine podcaster Shen and Jen of Potola Podcast, a conversational and fun wine podcast on the many different topics that relate to our favorite beverage.
Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, process, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome to the Looking Into Wine. I'm Mattia Scarpazza. Today's guest is a writer, lecturer, consultant, writes for Decanter, The World of Fine Wines. He's the author of 7 books on Portugal. Among them is a free version of Porto and Douro. Welcome to the podcast, Richard Mason.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Congratulations. You just released another book on Portugal called The Wines of Portugal. What was the moment that you fell in love for Portuguese wines?
Oh, that's goes back a long way. My first job after I left school, between getting to school and going to university, was in a bar and restaurant in southern Portugal. And the owners put me in charge of the wine list. And I knew nothing about wine at all at the time. It was just keeping it stocked. But I thought I ought to learn something. So I went up to Lisbon to buy some books on wine and sat there on my afternoons off, basically learning about wine. And then when I started traveling around Portugal in that same year, I started visiting vineyards I got the bug.
Definitely Portugal is your area of expertise, and I'm so happy to have you here today. In this book, you focused on the dry wines of Portugal. And
that's right.
So reading through the book, it shows that dry wines in Portugal have grown in interest among the producers and the quality. Why is that? What changed?
Well, the potential was always there. And Portugal was a frustrating place when I first got to know it as a child and later as a young adult. The climatically, Portugal is tremendous. It's a small country, but it has this enormous contrast within a small area. And so there's no greater contrast in a sense of styles of wine between Vinho Verde in the northwest of Portugal and some of the big alcoholic wines you get in southern Portugal, or of course Port, which is not a remit of this interview, but you know it's a completely contrasting wine. And it's a reflection of the very diverse climate and terroir that Portugal has, including its soils and geology and so on, and traditions.
There was one of the main points that I took away from the book. It was the fact that Portugal, when it joined the EU, the European Union, there's been a lot of investments done by the EU. How did they help, and what did they do?
It was also rewriting Portugal's wine law as well, because there was an awful lot of restrictive legislation dating back from before the 1974 revolution that really hadn't changed. And so Portugal was really in limbo from 1974 to 1986 when they joined the European Union. And really quite suddenly, quite quickly, in the last 3-4 years of the 1980s, things began to change. And it wasn't just about money. Money came in a bit later. Money didn't come in straight away. It wasn't just the investment. But it was also about changing the very nature of Portuguese wine and freeing the producers to do what they wanted. Again, that didn't happen overnight, but slowly and gradually, it's allowed a lot more initiatives to take place throughout the country without some of the restrictive legislation that there used to be, that was sort of set in stone, but was unnecessary.
Okay, and there was a lot of movement, and prior that, there was a lot of cooperative works done.
That's right. I was going to just give you an illustration of that. I mean, the Down region was entirely controlled by the cooperatives until Portugal joined the European Union. The cooperatives had a monopoly on all winemaking in the Down region. And Down was being marketed as being Portugal's leading wine region. And yet the region was underperforming woefully because the cooperatives just weren't selective enough. They weren't, the wines were, when I first joined the wine trade in 1984, on graduating from university, that the wines from Down were frankly a joke, and yet this was supposed to be Portugal's best wine, and it wasn't. And but if you did some research further back, there were examples of older Down wines from sort of pre the cooperative era. So the cooperatives really got going in the 1940s, 50s, and that's when they were given a monopoly on the region's winemaking. The old wines showed enormous potential, enormous great class. And yet the region was underperforming. It was, and so very frustrating, really, to see this for a long time. And a lot of heads had to be banged together, I think, in government and through some of the sort of vested interests in the regions themselves, to open up the country and open up to more investment and open up to more initiative.
Yeah, and now the DAO is one of the leading area for dry wines with the Touriga Nacional and its unique climate.
Absolutely, and a fabulous terroir, fabulous climate there. It's in that wonderful transition zone, which you can sort of draw a curved line through Portugal, where you find this transition between from the Atlantic to continental climate, and DAO is right in the middle of it. So it's influenced by the Atlantic, strongly influenced by the Atlantic. Sometimes you get a washout of a vintage with Atlantic rains and depressions coming in. Other years you get magnificent vintages there. But it's this sort of transition zone where I think that the magic comes from in Portugal, really. Having said that, I don't want to cast aspersions on the rest of Portugal, because there's some great wines coming from the whole country now, including the Algarve, which a few years ago nobody thought was capable of anything.
Talking of vintage, the vintage there, it was one of the, there was a whole page dedicated to how you explain the vintage variation is a big thing in Portugal. Why is that?
Portugal's people tend to think of Portugal as being a Mediterranean country because they go on holidays to the Algarve, but no point does Portugal touch the Mediterranean, and nowhere apart from parts of the Algarve does it have a Mediterranean climate. The climate is dominated by the Atlantic, and just as you get rain-bearing westerlies coming across, and we face them here in the UK, you get the same thing happening in Portugal. And okay, yes, the summer period in Portugal is usually dry, sometimes too dry, but there's never an Atlantic depression very far away, and you do get a huge variation in vintages, either from very wet weather in springtime, which can affect flowering and yields consequently, or you get it through rain falling during vintage itself, and it's unfortunate that vintage traditionally in the Douro Valley usually started on around about the 21st of September, around about the equinox. And that's exactly the time when the weather breaks for the first time and the first autumn depression comes in. So you get a huge variation from year to year. Fortunately, in recent years, there hasn't been a dreadful vintage in Portugal. I think the last really poor vintage in Portugal was probably 2002. Was not a great vintage, and then there was a disastrous vintage going back further in 1993, which was a complete washout. So the Portugal hasn't had a disastrous vintage for years, just as Bordeaux hasn't either. But north of Portugal and Bordeaux have a very similar sort of climatic regime in a way, because they're both next to the Atlantic.
And I remember when I travelled. The Douro Valley was the first region I visited. As a wine traveling. And I remember going from the Vinho Verde to the Douro Valley. There was the fog in the Vinho Verde, and you get through on the other side. It was incredible to see this difference. It was only like, I don't know, how many meters and area meters are there, but it's only a few. And it's so interesting.
It's extraordinary how the change comes. And in the summer months, I mean, the the Atlantic coast of Portugal can be sort of fog-bound because you've got this cold sea against the warm land. It's much the same as it is in Northern California. The same if you know San Francisco, you get these sort of fogs drifting in off the Pacific there. It's the same thing with Portugal. The sea isn't quite as cold there in the Atlantic, but it's the same contrast and it's the same thing. And that then diminishes very quickly as you go inland, just as it happened from the sort of Bay Area of San Francisco.
Okay, and roughly how many kilometers inland are we talking about? Because Portugal is not that big, so obviously there's a...
It's a narrow country. It's about 100 miles wide. That's all. It's not very far as you go across, but it's quite mountainous. Particularly the north of Portugal is quite mountainous. So the mountains actually really form the divide. And what divides the Vinha Verde region, which you mentioned, from the Douro, is a mountain range called the Serra do Marão, which isn't terribly high, snow capped in the winter, but it's a significant barrier. And the Douro region is in the rain shadow of the Serra do Marão, and it makes a huge difference, the rainfall. So whereas rainfall in parts of northern Portugal can be as much as 2,000 millimetres a year, by the time you get to the Douro Valley and you're inland, but they're about sort of between 60, 70 miles or so inland, you've got rainfall going down to about 600 millimetres a year. By the time you get to the Spanish frontier, you're getting sort of almost a drought territory where you're getting about 400 millimetres of rainfall a year. That makes a huge difference on the climate, the landscape, what can and can't be grown there. And of course, in terms of when it comes to vines, it's all about grape varieties and the style of wines they produce.
Yeah, I mean, talking of grape variety, Portugal has vast array of grapes. And while reading and researching for this, for many Portugal hasn't sort of gone through the Chardonnay or the Cabernet Sauvignon, and they still focus a lot on the national grape varieties.
Absolutely. There's a lot of pride in the national grape varieties there. A lot of sorting out has needed to be done. That's another thing that's come again with the EU. When I first got involved with Portuguese wines, most of the growers literally did not know what they had growing in their vineyards. And there was so much that most were interplanted. It was guesswork of what was growing in the vineyards, and there were an awful lot of varieties which were of not much worth. An awful lot of varieties have been planted for yield rather than for quality. Under the instigation of the cooperatives back in the sort of 50s and 60s, so a big sort out has taken place. But people have tried, I think, grape varieties like Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. Syrah has made a big impact on Portugal. Syrah is planted throughout most of the country now, and is surprising how important it is in Portugal now. But no, Portugal has focused on its better quality grapes. And it's grapes like Touriga Nacional, Touriga Franca, which is being reappraised and is now being held equally with Touriga Nacional as the best grape varieties there. Those grape varieties are so well adapted to places like the Douro, where you've got these arid drought conditions, unreliable rainfall, yet they're capable of producing great wines. And that's been proved for years in things like Vintage Port, now being proved in table wines or dry wines, as you call them.
Oh, in the book, there's all the book you give all the list of the grape varieties, which wine in half an hour we can't possibly go through them. But I invite everybody to go and have a look at them, because it's very detailed in each of them. But talking about this, the drying grape, the fact that the Portuguese grapes are adapted to the arid grapes. So do you think they are going to be used anywhere else in the world? Have you seen any like influence from Portuguese grapes around the world?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Bordeaux has recently adopted Touriga Nacional as it now permits Touriga Nacional for basic Bordeaux and Bordeaux Superior wines. They're thinking of the future and what might be happening with climate change. Alvarinho is another one that's now planted in Bordeaux. Alvarinho is debatable whether it's a Portuguese or a Spanish grape variety, but it covers the two places in northwest Portugal. So it's already happening, and there's lots of experimentation going on in California with Portuguese grapes and Australia as well. So yes, is the answer. They're there to conquer the world.
Well, we will see in a few years where they grow, and we find a good example of Touriga Nacional from anywhere in the world. It would be very interesting to follow. So in talking about Alvarinho and Vinha Verde, well, I mean, it's a very interesting region, And I mean, most of the people think that this region only produce white, but actually produce most of the region produce red wines. And what grape do they have, and why is called Vinho Verde?
Well, it's called Vinho Verde because it means green wine, and the coast of that area is called the Costa Verde, the green coast, and it describes very well what it is, because it's fairly damp, humid Atlantic climate, so it is very green the whole year round. But it's not because of that, actually. In fact, traditionally, Portuguese wine lists used to divide between vinhos verdes, green wines, and vinhos maduros, which was mature wines. So you'd have the green wines were basically the young wines, the wines to be drunk straight away, if you like, whereas the vinhos maduros were the wines that had been through cask and so on, were bottled and so on, and wines that were aging. That was the sort of crude distinction that you would find on traditional Portuguese wine lists. And so Vinho Verde was the wine to drink young, basically. That's what it really means. It's the wine to be drunk young. At one time, it was sort of thought as being a wine really just for knocking back, good with shellfish on the local beaches and that sort of thing. It was fizzy. It was a sort of pop wine, if you like. It had to be a lot more than that, partly because it has some great varieties. Not just Alvarinho, but there's another one called Loureiro, which is very promising as well. And it's producing wines of real quality now. And Alvarinho is capable of aging. It's not a wine necessarily that needs to can be drunk sort of, you know, yesterday. It's a wine that you can be drinking, the wine will develop over a few years. So I think probably the most exciting thing that's been going on recently in Portuguese wines in general is the overall improvement of white wines from the Vinho Verde right down into the Alentejo, where but particularly in those areas with the Atlantic influence or areas with higher altitude, where grape varieties are sort of being discovered that are making wines that are age-worthy and are really interesting. And of course, the Atlantic climate helps for these grapes to conserve their acidity. There's a variety which is called Arinto, which is grown throughout southern Portugal. It's also grown in the Vinhos Verdes under another name, less successfully there. But down in southern Portugal, where you've got a much hotter climate, a more arid climate, Arinto hangs on to its acidity almost wherever you plant it. And it's used for making varietal wines, but more often than not in blends to just give acidity, to help give acidity to natural acidity to other blends. So there's a lot of interesting wines and interesting things being uncovered over the years. There's still a lot more to come.
White wine from Portugal, it would be something to look at. I mean, I knew about Vinho Verde, but I haven't tried that many white wine, but definitely I'm going to have a look to try some more of them.
Have a look around. Trial and error. I think the other region that is worth looking at now for white wines is the Lisboa region. The Lisbon region, just north of there. Again, you've got that Atlantic climate there, and with the right grape varieties, some lovely wines are being made there now, white wines from there, very much influenced by the Atlantic.
I remember reading in the book, it was very interesting, this very close to the ocean and this very quite up-and-coming region in Portugal. Talking about up-and-coming, and you mentioned it earlier, there's one of the other regions, a part of Dão, has been Antelheiro. Sorry, my pronunciation.
Oh, Alentejo, sorry.
Alentejo, sorry. No, my Portuguese is not good. And how did that become one of the leading area of Portugal, and what makes it special? I know you had a vineyard there at some point.
I did have it in the north of Alentejo. Yeah, the Alentejo is special in that it's much flatter than the rest of Portugal. So when you get south of the Tagus, you get into this big rolling plain. And historically, the Alentejo had much larger land holdings, much larger units of land, whereas the north of Portugal is very fragmented. Means the agriculture was quite inefficient there, and one of the reasons why the cooperatives came to dominate there was the fact that they were trying to bring these small producers together. In the Alentejo, it's the opposite. It was the case. You got these huge estates down there, and it made it very easy to plant and to mechanize, particularly. Whereas the north of Portugal is very difficult to mechanize. You've been to the Douro, you know how difficult those terraced vineyards are up there. Well, it's like that all around the north of Portugal, and small holdings don't help either to mechanize. So the Alentejo, you could find vineyards with extending to sort of hundreds of hectares, whereas a lot of the vineyards in the north of Portugal extend to a fraction of a hectare. That's the difference. And also the Alentejo was the first to really rewrite the rule book. The region was actively discouraged before the revolution to plant grapes, plant vines in the Alentejo. And after the revolution, when things settled down, the region wrote its own rules again. And it was the first place to bring in Syrah, for example. It was the first places to bring in, it allowed a lot more flexibility. As a result, I think it captured people's imaginations. And these lovely, big, sort of ripe, fleshy red wines were coming out of the Alentejo, which were quite user-friendly in the sense that they were much easier on export markets. Well, traditionally, red wines from northern Portugal were sort of quite hard and tannic. These were much softer, easier, fruit-driven wines, and that's, I think, what captured people's imagination. But the Alentejo is a huge area. It's about a third of Portugal in total. And it goes all the way from the coast between Lisbon and the Algarve, all the way inland to Spain, and right up to the Tagus River. My vineyard was right in the very north of the Alentejo, where you've actually got some mountains there. And I chose that area because it's that little bit cooler. I mean, Alentejo gets some pretty extreme heat, and you really can't do much without irrigation there in these vineyards. We were doing dry farm vineyards up in the north of the Alentejo because we had the rainfall, we had the springs, we had the right terroir and climate up there to be able to do that. So the Alentejo is difficult to generalize without the Alentejo because it's a big area producing lots of different styles of wine.
And one of them is called the Vino de Taglia.
Yes, that's a revival of an old tradition.
So what is it? And I discovered it through the book. I never come across it before.
Taglias are the way the wines are traditionally made in the Alentejo. They're big clay pots. I can't tell you exactly what the capacity of them is. They vary, of course. It's where the wines were made privately in these big, huge clay pots and stored in there. And Vini d'Italia has now become it's now been written to the legislation so that producers now can make wine in the traditional way in these clay pots, Taglia wine. The producer that kept it going for all these years was a producer with a long name, shortened now to José de Souza in Reguengos de Monserrage. And it belongs to José Maria de Fonseca, a big, big producer. And they kept it going and restored the tradition, really. And it's there's a spectacular adega there, winery there, where there must be, I don't know how many pots there are in there, but there's sort of 50 or 60 of these great clay pots all being used for fermenting wines. Quite labor intensive. Wines will never be cheap. And seems to lend itself to the Alentejo's ripe fruit.
Okay. I mean, I can see a market for this sort of wine, and especially in England, I can see people being interested in these wines. And for me, it's very interesting talking. I mean, obviously, we haven't talked about the Douro Valley because I think they deserve a different chat altogether and is a whole region by itself. But for me, it was very interesting to speak about dry wines of Portugal, and definitely something to grow. And I don't think I've seen in the book, but is there any like dry wine made in Madeira, or is just...
Yes, there is. The Azores and Madeira are becoming increasingly interesting. There's quite a lot of interest, of course, in wines coming from volcanic soils. And both the Azores or Açores and Madeira are both volcanic. Totally different traditions there, with different climates. Madeira has a subtropical climate, but it has altitude as well. So within a small area, as you go up in altitude, the vegetation changes, and of course the grape varieties change as well. I'm careful what I say about this because my wife's family are producers of Madeira wine, and I adore their fortified wines. This Blandy. I'm not such a fan of the dry wines from Madeira as yet. They're using Madeira's traditional grapes, including for reds, Tinta Negra, which I'm not convinced necessarily is the right grape for a red wine. There may be well be a lot more to be said for something from Verdelho, which is a white grape variety, of course, makes amazing fortified wines that can some of the longest live wines in the world, and may well be capable. Certainly a Verdelho, whether it's the same Verdelho in Australia, is making some great wines down there. Whether that comes in Madeira, I'm not sure yet. But I reserve my judgment at the moment.
Okay, well, for me it's interesting. I mean, I know Madeira is only a handful of producers, and it's interesting to see them start doing some dry wine there. And definitely, with all the Portugal, the interest is there to produce more dry wine. I mean, and just I got for the last couple of questions, there was this difference on the labeling called Encruzado and Garrafera.
Well, okay. Encruzado is a grape variety. Encruzado is a grape variety that's planted really in the Douro region. And it's a variety that's become it's one of Portugal's leading white grape varieties. It's not the easiest grape variety to grow, but it retains its acidity, and it's a wine that actually gets, it has some body as well, and produces wines which are capable of oak aging, so that they take on a sort of Burgundian quality to them. So it's potentially one of Portugal's leading grape varieties, which at the moment is only planted really in the Douro region. And so you see Encruzado wines now, varietal wines coming out of there. Garrafera is totally different. Garrafera is a category of wine which, when I first started out in the wine trade, was much more common than it is today. And the word Garrafera means private cellar in Portuguese. And it was a wine that was used by these big negociant companies, merchant firms, who were buying in wines, often from the cooperatives at one time, and they would reserve their best wines and bottle it under a Garrafera label. And so there were some great wines coming there, but the frustrating thing with Garrafera in those days was you never knew where it was coming from. So there was no regional definition on it at all. It was somebody's Garrafera could come from the Ribatejo one year or the Douro the next, depending on where the quality of the wine was. It was just, but some of these wines were very long living and really, very, very impressive, and they were it was the best category of wine in Portugal before the whole country got demarcated and so on in the way it is now. So you don't see Garrafera now in the way it did then. It was like the sort of Grand Reserva, if you like, of Portugal in those days. But there were no rules attached to it. It was a wine that was your Garrafera was your best wine.
Okay, it was the producer name in deciding that it was the barrel or the selection. Okay,
it was deciding the selection. And as I say, it wasn't necessarily a region not attached to it at all.
Okay, I mean, I got a last question because. I mean, if I was to sort of look to explore dry wines, I never tried dry wines from Portugal. And if I choose like three regional style, where would you start for like some listeners that want to start exploring? It's difficult.
Where would you start? It depends what style of wine you like. Portugal has wines for everyone. And I think I love the Vinha Verde region. I love the Vinha. It's not just Alvarinho, but also Loureiro. Other varieties there as well, and I love these wines. I love the minerality of them. I know that's a word that's rather overused now, but I love that steely quality of them, and particularly if you like wines that are lower in alcohol, you still find Vinhos Verdes around about sort of 11.5 alcohol, 12, you know, these days when we're now seeing wines going at sort of 13, 14, it's quite refreshing, and they always have this high level of natural acidity. So that's somewhere I would go for a white wine. And I dream in these days of lockdown of being on a beach in northern Portugal with a glass of Vinha Verde and a plate of shellfish. Nothing better, no better combination.
This was a nice start.
I think if you're looking for the contrasting wines, for red, I would go into the Douro. Because I think the Douro has obviously proved its potential over the years with port wine. But with improvements in technique and technology and just knowledge generally of vineyards and grape varieties, there are some really expressive, potentially long-lived reds coming out of Douro with the reds that may be made there now. So that's really at the opposite spectrum from Vinha Verde. If you're looking for really accessible wines, easy drinking wines, go to the south of Portugal, go to the Tejo region, which is has been underperforming, but actually has some lovely wines there, and it is not appreciated. And the Alentejo, because there are some lovely, soft, easygoing, fleshy wines there, which don't require perhaps as much thought as the Douro wines do. They're not as tannic, they're not as astringent, they're not as, but they're just easy to drink. And that's what's made them very popular restaurant wines in Portugal.
Okay, I mean, it's all a trip throughout the Porto region. I mean, thank you, Richard. I want to thank you for this half an hour together. And I mean, congratulations again on your book, The Wines of Portugal. It's a brilliant book, and also all the other books on Portugal, Madeira and Douro. I got a couple of editions of your Douro and Port book. So I'm a pleasure to have you here today.
It's been good to talk to you.
I would like to thank today's guest, Richard Mason, author of the book, The Wines of Portugal, for his time and sharing his knowledge with us. Also, remember to hit the follow button to the podcast. And as always, please remember to leave a review. You can reach us on Instagram on mattia.lookingintowine and Mattia Scarpazza on all other social medias. If you're enjoying and would like to support the podcast, you can donate on mattiascarpazza.com. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.